Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Rebecca Thies of the Economic Policy Institute on the politics of deficit reduction and how to do it better than the mainstream is looking for. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll get a report from Kyle Ashe, who is at the Cancun Climate Talks on behalf of Greenpeace. But first, some words in the news. Try as one might, it's hard to find something good to say about the U.S. employment report for November, which was released on Friday morning. But all you can say is this, at least it wasn't negative. The total gain of 39,000 jobs was the weakest number since May and less than half the average this year. Those calculations exclude the effects of temporary census workers who swelled the ranks of the employed early in the year as they were hired and depressed the numbers later as they were shown the door. The private sector gain of 50,000 was the weakest since January, and also less than half the year's average. Gains were concentrated in only a few sectors, temp firms, healthcare, and bars and restaurants. Several major sectors lost jobs, construction, manufacturing, finance, and retail. The public sector also fell, mainly because of local government. While employment was weak, earnings were weaker. Average hourly pay was unchanged. Over the year, the hourly wage is up around 2%, one of the weakest numbers in the 46-year history of this series. Anyone worried about inflation, and some of our fiscal and monetary hawks are just that, is seeing phantoms. The numbers I've been quoting come from a survey of employers, 300,000 of them, a very large survey. The simultaneous survey of households, 60,000 of them, not quite as large, but still very large as these things go, was mostly weaker. The share of the adult population employed fell slightly, taking this measure to its lowest level in nearly a year, and about to the level it was at in the early 1980s before the expansions of the 1980s and 1990s took it to a record high. The unemployment rate rose by two ticks to 9.8%, its highest level since April. And all of that increase was among job losers, especially permanent job losers. The number of new entrants and re-entrants was actually down. Employment continues to track the international post-financial crisis average with uncanny precision. If history is any guide, that means sluggish job growth should continue well into next year. We need more stimulus, but the drift of politics these days is towards less. Speaking of which, the Deficit Commission was unable to come to a consensus in a vote taken on Friday, meaning that they won't drop an austerity package in Congress's lap for a vote. Thank God for gridlock. As a friend pointed out to me just after that vote, the French have their street theater, but they still got their pensions cut. Spain eviscerated a welfare state that took a generation to build, all without a peep. But the U.S. elite, which would love to cut Social Security and Medicare, is having a hard time doing a deal. We may see the Obama administration take a lead to force some kind of compromise package early in the new year, but we can only hope that the Republicans will continue to block everything he wants to do, no matter how right-wing the content. I've had a lot to say about the recommendations of the Deficit Commission's co-chairs, Wall Street Democrat Erskine Bowles, and Wyoming Republican Yahoo Alan Simpson in recent weeks, so there's no need to reprise that. And we'll hear some more on this topic from Rebecca Thies in a few minutes. But I did want to flesh out my speculation of a couple of weeks ago on their proposal to eliminate a bunch of tax breaks and simultaneously lower rates. Bowles and Simpson claim that the effect of that move would be neutral to progressive, but the Tax Policy Center ran the numbers and found, just as I suspected, that the co-chairs were lying. The Tax Policy Center estimates that the changes would raise taxes by several hundred dollars a year for the bottom 80% of the population, and the further you go down the income ladder, the bigger they hit in percentage terms. The top 20%, though, would see a tax cut under this scheme averaging over $1,700. The top 1%, average income around $2 million, would get a cut of over $7,000. Among the upper orders, only the very richest, a top 0.1%, average income around $9 million, would see their taxes rise. Beware of elitists proffering social justice. Earlier in the week, the Federal Reserve released information showing just how much money they spread around during the financial crisis of 2008. We knew the numbers were big, but now they've attached some names to the numbers. Just about all the big banks borrowed heavily from the Fed, including Goldman Sachs, which claimed at the time that it didn't need any help. Wall Street owes its very existence today to the federal government that many of them profess to hate. Man, do those capitalists ever have a good deal. And speaking of capitalists, it was inspiring to read Diane Ravitch's takedown of Bill Gates on a Washington Post blog the other day. Ravitch used to be a supporter of the right-wing education agenda, testing, privatization, charter schools, and so on, but had the sort of evidence-driven change of heart that's rare in politics, so she junked the agenda and became one of its sharpest critics. I had her on this show back in April to discuss her excellent book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. In the Washington Post interview, she defends teachers against the slurs that Gates and other pro-market reformers throw at them, and also makes this crucial point. The single biggest correlate with low academic achievement, contrary to the film Waiting for Superman, is poverty. Children who grow up in poverty get less medical care, worse nutrition, less exposure to knowledge and vocabulary, and are more likely to be exposed to childhood diseases, violence, drugs, and abuse. They are, Ravitch continues, more likely to have relatives who are incarcerated. They are more likely to live in economic insecurity, not knowing if there's enough money for a winter coat or food or housing. This affects their academic performance. They tend to have lower attendance and to be sick more than children whose parents are well off. The U.S. today has a child poverty rate of over 20%, and it's rising. This is a national scandal. The film, Waiting for Superman, compares us to Finland, but doesn't mention that their child poverty rate is under 5%. Mr. Gates, why don't you address the causes of low academic achievement, which is not bad teachers, but poverty? That's the end of the quote from Ravitch. Of course, billionaires don't like to talk about addressing poverty because it might mean giving up their billions. Gates, it must be said, does some good philanthropic work on health in particular, but still, all philanthropists want to retain control of the money and of the agenda rather than democratizing both. But why is Bill Gates, the graduate of a posh private high school who never did finish college, revered as an authority about public education, a topic about which he knows next to nothing? I suspect the major reason is that he's regarded as a business genius, as if business genius were translatable to pedagogy or anything else. If Gates is that rich, he must be smart, eh? But he's really not such a business genius. Well, I guess he's a business genius of a sort, but not of the heroic entrepreneur kind that's usually lionized. His first foray into code writing was a version of BASIC, the computer language, for some early hobbyist machines written with fellow future mega-billionaire Paul Allen. BASIC was originally developed at Dartmouth, a nonprofit educational institution, but Gates was already learning how to take the work of others and turn it into his own property. What really made Gates rich, though, was having been in the right place at the right time in 1981 when IBM needed an operating system for its new PC. Gates, with Allen, borrowed heavily, to put it gently, from an existing operating system, Digital Research's CPM. According to Digital Research's own, perhaps interested, version of this history, Microsoft paid Seattle Software Works for an unauthorized clone of CPM, and Microsoft licensed this clone to IBM. In other words, this was another instance of adopting someone else's work and taking credit for it, this time with the innovation of litigating aggressively and manipulating markets to defend a monopoly position. Because once it secured that monopoly, Microsoft did everything it could to crush the competition. Having secured that early market dominance with MS-DOS, Microsoft became a money machine. It earned monopoly profits with almost no cost of production. But after that, aside from Office, Microsoft has been unable to launch a truly successful product on its own creative juices. Windows, at first a gussied-up version of MS-DOS, was basically lifted from the Macintosh operating system, which Apple itself had lifted from Xerox, and it took years before they got Windows right. Many Windows releases have been extremely buggy and bloated. Explorer is a pretty crummy browser. Microsoft's efforts on the web, like Hotmail and Bing, have been disappointing. Their attempt to imitate the iPod, Zune, is a joke. Microsoft has lost money in video games, despite the enormous growth in that market. So it's pretty rich for Gates to criticize monopoly and stodginess in public education, given this business history. His father was, among other things, an intellectual property lawyer, which did teach him something about gaining advantage in a world where the innovation of others can threaten monopoly profits. The University of Washington Law School's Center for Advanced Study and Research in Intellectual Property is actually headquartered in a building named after Gates Sr. But there's nothing terribly admirable about using litigation and market power to become a billionaire. And that sort of personal and business history certainly doesn't give you the credentials to hold forth an education policy. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk deficits. That was some of Stockhausen's Klavierstück, a number 11, second version, performed by Elizabeth Klein. Now to deficits. To counter all the austerity propaganda circulating, the Economic Policy Institute recently put out a progressive plan for deficit reduction. Here's one of its authors, Rebecca Thies, to talk about it and the broader political context. Welcome, Rebecca Thies. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the proposals of the so-called Deficit Commission, Erskine Bowles and Owen Simpson. It doesn't look like they're going to get a majority vote on from their colleagues. So is their proposal going to go anywhere?
You know, they refer to their proposal as a starting point. They called it an adult conversation a couple times yesterday during their public meeting. And, you know, I think that what they're really hoping is that Congress takes some of their ideas seriously. We know that they're not going to get the 14 votes, but I think, you know, what they hope is that Congress will take their plan seriously and that this conversation will continue.
What are the core elements of their plan?
They reduce deficits by around $4 trillion through 2020. That's an incredible amount of money. They're charged with balancing the primary budget by 2015. That's basically spending and revenues minus interest payments. And they actually went further than that. If they were to balance the primary budget by 2015, that would equal a 3% deficit in that year. And they actually make enough cuts and enough revenue increases to get down to 2.3% in deficit reduction. However, they do so in what we believe is a very austere way. They enact numerous spending cuts that, you know, that would have very detrimental effects on people who are already feeling sort of the pain of the economic downturn. You know, the major problem with the Commission's proposals, I believe, is that they seem to ignore the fact that we're still in a very bad economic place. The cuts that they propose start in 2012, fiscal year 2012, which actually starts next October. And at that time, unemployment is still projected to be very high. The Federal Reserve projects it at 9%, and independent analysts projected 9.7%. So they enact, you know, numerous spending cuts starting in 2012 that would have very detrimental effects.
How urgent is it to get that close to budget balance? When you talk about 2% or 3%, you're talking as a percentage of GDP, right?
Yes, I am.
How urgent is it to get to that level of fiscal propriety that quickly? Do we really need to get there in 3 or 4 years?
No. You know, I believe that everybody who's interested in this subject has sort of the same views on what the end result should be, and what we differ on is the means to the end. This fiscal commission and other commissions like it believe that deficit reduction is the key towards a stronger economy and the end of sort of the recession that we've seen. And we believe that the key to that is job creation and is investment. And so deficit reduction is not necessarily the key towards a stronger economy. There's an economist that I work with, John Irons, who has proposed a 6-for-6 trigger. And by that I mean no deficit reduction should take place until the economy has been at 6% unemployment for 6 months or more. We think that job growth is the key towards a strong economy and that deficit reduction should not be pursued in the near term or in the medium term until we've seen lower unemployment levels.
And 6% is still relatively high by historic standards. That's not a low unemployment rate.
No, it's certainly not that low. You know, when you're talking about the 4% unemployment in the late 90s when we had surpluses, but we believe that we have to at least get unemployment down, you know, significantly before any austerity measures should begin. We have a plan out that we just put out at the Economic Policy Institute called Investing in America's Future, and that is a progressive deficit reduction plan.
All right, I want to get to that in a moment, but just one more question. What is driving this mania to reduce the deficit very quickly? Is it ideology? Is there some political machinations? Is it material interests? Why this obsession with balancing the budget in just a few years?
Right. Well, deficits are very high right now. You know, they're at $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion last year. And it's really giving deficit hawks an open window into controlling the debate. You've got President Obama, I think, sending mixed messages. He's on the one hand telling us that stimulus spending is necessary to, you know, bring our economy back to where it should be, back to full potential. On the other hand, he's creating a fiscal commission to look into deficit reduction. And that sort of mixed messaging has really given deficit hawks a window into controlling the debate, into pushing their fear-mongering that deficits are really, really harmful for this economy. When what's really harmful is the lack of jobs that are out there, you know, the number of people that are unemployed right now, that's what we should be afraid of. These large deficits will go when the economy recovers. And, you know, the people who are pushing such strident deficit reduction are people who would be pushing it in times of good or in times of bad, and they've just really had an open window during this recession to get their message through.
Well, a lot of the deficit hawks have just been gunning for Social Security and Medicare forever, and this just looks like a perfect pretext for them, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that's very true. You know, Social Security is running a $2.5 trillion surplus, and it's expected to be able to pay out full benefits for another 27 years. It's not adding a dime to the deficit, yet for some reason, it's in every single debate that we're having today. Well, how can we fix Social Security? When really that's a completely separate debate to be having. Social Security will need minor tweaks here and there in the years to come to keep the program solvent, but it's not adding to our deficit now. It's not going to be adding to our deficit in the near future. And the fact that it's part of this commission's report just doesn't make any sense.
Okay, now let's turn to what the Economic Policy Institute is proposing. What kind of investment scheme do you have to get the deficit down?
Right, well, we believe that the key towards a stronger economy is, you know, built-in job creation and an investment in this country. And we think that job creation is the key towards bringing down deficits as well. We think that there's a long-term fiscal imbalance that does need to be addressed. We don't think that it should be addressed through strict spending reductions. These are programs that actually exist that, you know, help people in this country, and if they were cut, it would mean a loss of jobs. So we leave domestic spending pretty much alone and actually increase public investment in the 10-year period by over $2 trillion. So we actually believe in pumping the economy full of more money during this time when people are in such need. What we do to bring deficits under control is actually increase a number of revenues, reform tax expenditures, and cut defense savings. And, you know, in terms of health care, we propose a number of different policies that were discussed within the president's health care bill that could work towards cost containment if they are expanded upon. We think that those should be expanded and become a big part of bringing our deficits down. So we think that healthcare cost containment along with major defense savings and some revenue increases can help us achieve long-term debt sustainability. And our report does a very good job of showing, you know, how we can get our budget into balance. We have a primary surplus by 2018, and we don't cut spending for anybody.
You mentioned some revenue changes. Bowles and Simpson in their proposal would want to eliminate a bunch of tax breaks, both corporate and personal. At the same time, they want to lower the overall rate. What do you think of the idea of, you know, simplifying, reducing brakes, but lowering rates? What's the EPI position on that?
You know, the tax code certainly does need to be simplified. And like the Fiscal Commission and our report, we take on a lot of tax expenditures, which, you know, is really a good deal of money. It's $1.1 trillion this year in tax expenditures. And that's money that's not subject to the normal budget process. It's, you know, politicians are not held accountable for it. So we believe that a lot of that needs to be reformed, and the Fiscal Commission agrees with us. But I think the main difference between the way we look at taxes and the way they look at taxes is they use the simplification of the tax code to lower tax rates. And we believe that if you're simplifying the tax code, it should go towards greater investment and deficit reduction. And, you know, we just don't think – we already have some of the lowest tax rates in the world, and it's just not necessary to for this push to lower them even further. There's a, you know, a mantra in the conservative movement that tax rates can never be low enough. And I think the people who are really very seriously interested in fiscal responsibility and a strong economy recognize that we need a sustainable level of revenue to keep us afloat. You know, we've got the baby boomers retiring in the next few years, and we've got healthcare cost growth just projected to explode. And so paring down revenue levels is a really bad idea, as is the Fiscal Commission's proposal to cap revenues at 21% of GDP, which is very low compared to where projected spending is going to be. So we need revenues that are competitive with spending, and their proposal just does not do that.
You've been using the term tax expenditures, and people may not know what that is. So could you define that and then give us an idea of the kinds of things that EPI would like to eliminate?
Tax expenditures refer to the preferences and deductions in the tax code. You know, they're numerous, whether you're talking about the mortgage interest deduction or the earned income tax credit. This is all spending through the tax code. So it's a gray area. It's an area that some people look at as spending and some people look at as taxes, and that's why it's become so popular, because politicians can go to their constituents and say, oh, well, you know, I haven't raised spending. I've just given you this credit. But really, it's both. It's spending and taxes. You know, what EPI would like to see, for example, is converting some tax deductions to tax credits. We limit the mortgage interest deduction. We tax capital gains and dividends as ordinary income. The Fiscal Commission does the same thing. You know, it's important that capital gains and dividends are taxed at a rate that is fair. The fact that you've got middle and lower income people paying these tax rates, and, you know, capital gains and assets are taxed at 0% or 15%, it's just not a very, very fair rate. So we change a lot of these rates. We have a charitable giving deduction that we reform, and, you know, we end up having about a third of our deficit reduction through reforming tax expenditures.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Thies, who is a policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. And tell us about your investment program. What kind of economic payoff would that offer for deficit reduction over the longer term?
We believe that investing now can really save later. So we pump investments into the economy. We begin with $200 billion in 2011, increase that to $250 billion in 2012, and then grow that number with GDP afterwards. And we specify certain areas within our report that we think would see very high returns, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean we're not open to other types of investments. We just sort of targeted certain areas that we think see a really high bang for the buck. These include early childhood education, infrastructure, public transit, health IT, research and development, tax credits, rural broadband connectivity. These are all areas. I'll just take early childhood education as an example. When you invest in early childhood education, those students are impacted for the rest of their lives. You know, they tend to do better in high school. They graduate. They go on to college. It's actually proven that they have a higher income than they would if they hadn't had these programs available to them. And higher income means you know, they pay more in taxes. It's good for the economy all around. They're producing, they're contributing, and they're paying into our revenue stream. So early childhood education is just one example that has lifelong benefits for both the individual and society. It keeps, you know, more people out of prisons. That's a cut cost for society. It's just all in all a good idea as an investment.
And what kind of infrastructure investments do you have in mind?
We talk about roads. We talk about bridges. You know, we're very, very distressed to see things like bridges crumbling. Not only the fact that people get injured, but, you know, it's not a good thing at all. We want state-of-the-art infrastructure. You know, it creates jobs. It keeps people safe. And, you know, in the long run, these things are going to have to be brought up to speed at some point anyway. And so doing it sooner ends up costing less than pushing those changes down the road. So it's both, you know, waterways, bridges, our drinking water system, roads and highways, and other infrastructure changes.
Some of this stuff was what was in the stimulus package that Congress passed last year. And now I think the standard argument among a lot of pundits is that the stimulus didn't work. So they're going to say, you know, why should it work this time if we tried it again? How do you respond to that critique that the stimulus was a failure?
The Congressional Budget Office and other groups have come out with reports saying the stimulus created something like 3 million jobs, impacted GDP growth by a significant amount. And the thing that we think is that there just wasn't enough stimulus to really make an impact. I don't think people are really aware of quite the situation we would be in if there hadn't been the stimulus spending that there was. Our GDP would be down compared to where it is today. We would have significantly higher unemployment than we do right now. So, you know, President Obama was exactly right to enact a large stimulus package, and the only thing we think was wrong with it was that it wasn't larger. You know, it could have been targeted a little bit better, too. There are different stimulative policies that have various effects. You know, for instance, aid to states brings back a very high bang for the buck. Food stamps brings back a very high bang for the buck. There are other policies that just have less of an effect. Tax cuts is one of those, for an example. You know, his stimulus package included a number of tax cuts. Those bring back significantly less in GDP growth on the dollar than other stimulative programs do.
And then what kind of savings are you looking for out of the Pentagon?
What we do is adopt the policies recommended by the Bipartisan Sustainable Defense Task Force. That was a group convened by Representative Barney Frank. It included a number of national security experts. You know, these are not people that are looking to strip our country of its military funding. These are people who are actually experts and who, you know, who know where there's inefficiencies and where we can make some changes for the better. That group came up with $960 billion in savings from the Department of Defense, and we have adopted that number as a reasonable standard for spending cuts in the Department of Defense. So we end up spreading that out over 10 years in our report for, you know, a total of almost $1 trillion worth of cuts to defense. That includes everything from overseas contingency operations to, you know, just greater efficiency measures.
Now, I'm guessing that the atmosphere in Washington had not been all that friendly to this sort of thing earlier in the year, but now that we have a new configuration in Congress coming in, this is really going to be an uphill fight. How's it looking?
You know, it's going to be a big uphill fight. You've got Congress right now in a battle for unemployment and unemployment benefits, for extending those. That's a cost of $65 billion if we extended that throughout next year. That's really not that much money, especially when you compare it to, say, extending the Bush tax cuts for, you know, the wealthiest 2 or 3% of Americans. That's projected to cost around the same amount in 1 year as extending unemployment benefits would cost. So, you know, what I hope we can do is just get out the message that this is about priorities. Would you like to extend tax cuts for people who will basically sit on the money because they're so wealthy anyway? Or would you like to extend unemployment benefits during a time when people are really hurting? And, you know, those are the types of battles that we're going to be having, and it's going to get more difficult come January.
That was Rebecca Thies, who's a policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. This is a lot more cautious than I'd like, but then again, I didn't write the report. What is wrong with stripping the U.S. military of its power anyway? You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, or on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk climate.
In the tall buildings sit the head of all nations, worthy men from Spain and Siam. All day discussions with the Russians, but they still went ahead and beat all the plan. Now up jumped the U.S. representative. He's the one with the tight eyes. 747 for him in that condition, flying back from a peacekeeper mission. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
That was some of Nick Lowe's So It Goes, one of the few pop songs about international diplomacy that I could think of. The latest iteration of the UN climate talks is going on in Cancun, Mexico, right now, with not much attention being paid at all to them in the U.S. For a report on the goings-on, I thought I'd call on Greenpeace's representative down there, Kyle Esch. Apologies for the sound quality, but calling him was like trying to call the old Soviet Union. There are no landlines available. We started out on Skype, which dropped out, and then we finally got his cell phone to work after he'd been acting flaky for much of the day. Kyle Esch.
Welcome, Kyle. I guess it's nice to go to Cancun in the winter, but that's not why you're down there, right?
No, it is not. We're here for climate talks, which happen every year. Last year was in Copenhagen. It was a lot colder than here. The weather is good here, but so far it's been a little bit slow in productivities.
All right, so give us an idea how this fits into a process. I think the workings of the UN are mysterious to most people, so this is part of a whole process of negotiation. Just tell us how it fits in.
Yeah, so this is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The convention as in meeting, which the main one happens every year. The convention as in the treaty was signed in 1992. This is the 16th annual meeting. And the U.S. is a party among 193 other countries.
And what exactly is under negotiation? We're facing climate catastrophe, and it does seem like the pace of negotiation is remarkably leisurely. What's on the agenda right now?
Well, I would say that it's leisurely in part because expectations are a little bit low for what's going to be achieved in Cancun, and it's not because something can't be achieved. It's mainly due to the fact that governments, including the United States, have lowered everybody's expectations and what they think could be achieved here. But the other reason is that we had expectations of a treaty that would include the United States last year in Copenhagen. Those are reasonable expectations because the U.S. signed onto a plan in Bali in 2007 that this would happen, that they would agree to all the issues with all the countries in Copenhagen. So that didn't happen. It was a huge disappointment. People are still walking around with wounds from back in Denmark. So there's really two reasons productivity is kind of slow right now, but they are making some progress on some key issues.
In last year's negotiations, at least in the U.S., China was presented as something of a villain. How is China figuring in this year's negotiations?
Well, so far we haven't heard a whole lot about what China is doing. I mean, I think that their positions are very similar to in Copenhagen. The dynamics between the U.S. and China are the same, but we're hearing less about it. And I think that's for a few different reasons. People have lower expectations here than they did in Copenhagen for a lot of reasons. They were supposed to have a treaty in Copenhagen according to the decision that was made 2 years prior. So now we're starting off with the tone a lot more tempered, I guess you would say. But the other thing is that in Tianjin and before that, even people are seeing the policies that China is coming out with domestically. And in comparison to the U.S., they're really good. I mean, they're promoting renewable energy to a greater extent than we are through public financing. Their vehicles emissions policies are better than ours are. Really, the main reason that we were so focused on China and the U.S. press and worldwide is because the U.S. doesn't want us to look at the U.S. weak target or the fact that the U.S. financing isn't quite enough. And so the dynamics are a little bit different here in Cancun.
Yeah, this actually makes me wonder what the negotiations are all going to be about, because the U.S. really doesn't seem serious. I mean, what can these sorts of negotiations accomplish as long as the world's first or second largest greenhouse gas emitter, I guess we're now number two behind China, really won't entertain any serious proposals about doing anything?
Well, first of all, we are number two in terms of day-to-day emissions, but it's important to remember that the U.S. is still responsible for the most emissions in the atmosphere. So because the CO2 is up there for centuries, it will be a while before the U.S. is not the most responsible for emissions up there. But the U.S. is doing the same thing that they were doing in Copenhagen. And the reasons we don't know, the message basically that we're getting is that the U.S. wants to stall on getting an agreement. And we don't know for how long. Now they're talking about legislation again, whereas leading up to now, they were saying that to meet the commitment that they put up in Copenhagen, they're going to use existing laws and policies, such as the EPA or state legislation. But now they're talking again about federal legislation to reduce emissions. So if their mindset is that we're going to have to wait for legislation to get U.S. to sign onto a legal treaty, then they are talking about in 3 years, because they're also saying we're not going to have legislation in the next 2 years.
Yet, if we had were able to accomplish so little while the Democrats had a solid majority in Congress and the president was new and enthusiastic and had something of a mandate, what are we going to get out of the new configuration in Washington?
Well, first of all, the way out of it in terms of U.S. foreign policy is that Obama makes climate a priority. And he has yet to do what we saw during the healthcare debate, which is to publicly campaign for the policy. He didn't do that on climate legislation, and we know even that the White House staff is minimally involved in promoting the climate legislation and the administration's agenda in the climate legislation. And so that died. We didn't have the president use his free access to press, which we desperately needed to push that, and it's also not happening on the international level. But the bit of optimism that I still have is that if the president is referring to historical precedent on what helped to increase public opinion of the president's job, then after the midterms elections, which he lost a lot of seats in the Congress to the Republicans and they took the House. When that's happened in the past, the Democratic president said basically they were going to use their executive authority as much as they could over the next 2 years until there's another election. And in the past, as with Truman and with Clinton, the effect of that strategy was that they looked like a really strong leader, and then they won their second term as president. So if Obama decides he wants to be a strong leader, he could do this by promoting strong climate policy and campaigning for climate policy. Between now and his election, he could build himself up as a great leader on this issue and other issues using executive power, and it could very well help him in the election.
The under current law, the EPA has substantial power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. I think the Republicans would like to change that, but now they do have it. Do you see any optimism on that front?
Well, if you're looking at what EPA could do, then definitely there's optimism because they have purview over the same amount of emissions that the Waxman-Markey House legislation on climate that passed in 2009 had, which is 85% of the economy's emissions. EPA could come up with policies to address almost all the economy's emissions. They're already rolling out regulations that pertain to both stationary sources, as in coal plants or smokestacks, and vehicles. And the vehicle standards start in 2012. They're already talking about standards that would begin in 2017, which would be strong enough to also promote electric vehicles, because petroleum prices are probably going to go up, because we're already hearing that it's peak emissions, if not soon. Peak production of oil, if not soon. And also, it's cheaper and cheaper to make more efficient cars. We're already seeing car companies starting to roll these out. So I definitely see promise in just using EPA regulations. And we should also note that the regulations that EPA is rolling out, which do not pertain to greenhouse gases, but pertain to air pollution of other sorts, like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide, those will end up in reducing greenhouse gas emissions as well, because this is an updating of emissions standards on all kinds of pollutants that industry has been pushing back on for decades in some cases. And it's all coming to a head. It's going to be putting pressure on extremely dirty coal plants, for instance, which are responsible for about a third of U.S. emissions. And we think we could have about a quarter of coal plants phased out over the next decade, or even better than that. So I definitely see some promise.
Is that timetable really fast enough? I mean, if we're talking about a quarter of coal plants over the next decade, I mean, is that really quick enough to deal with the problem?
Well, so if we're talking about over the next decade, this is just what we see coming now. The answer to your question is no, that's not enough. Neither is the target that the U.S. announced in Copenhagen. It's 3% below 1990 emissions by 2020. That's less than one-tenth of the U.S. target if they were to be following what science demands, which is more like 25 to 40% of reductions in emissions. But what EPA is doing could get out the pledge that Obama gave in Copenhagen. And over the next decade, we could be seeing other policies to shore up the gap between that 3% and the 25 to 40%. And those could come through new legislation. It could come through other standards that the EPA is rolling out. We don't know, actually, the effect that's going to come from the greenhouse gas emissions restrictions that EPA will be proposing for stationary sources. We have yet to hear from the states what they plan to do in response to the EPA rule. There's a bit of an open question there. EPA always has the ability to strengthen the regulations, and if they're following their own mandate, they will have to, because with the current rules as they stand, they're not going to be strong enough, and they need to have rules that reduce endangerment to public health. That's the whole point of the rules.
I was speaking with Kyle Ash of Greenpeace, who is at the climate negotiations in Mexico. Let's talk about some of the other players, important emitters, and their role in the negotiations. What, if anything, is the EU contributing to the process?
So the EU has mostly been a good player. They are part of the Kyoto Protocol, so they have obligations from that. I should also just remind people that the U.S. signed the Kyoto Protocol. It's not really legally possible to unsign it, although everyone accepts the U.S. will not participate in it. So the EU has been reducing their emissions according to the Kyoto Protocol. They're probably going to be meeting their target. This period for the Kyoto Protocol ends in 2012. In terms of what they've committed to do now in a new agreement, they're proposing to reduce 20% of their emissions under 1990 levels by 2020. We think that they'll end up putting down 30%, because they said 30% conditional. And it's conditional on what the U.S. puts down for emissions reductions and with finance and all the other issues. But EU's analyses of the EU target of 30% is that it will actually be better for their economy to have the stronger pollution reduction target. So we think they'll do that. And in terms of being a good negotiating partner, they've been really good. They've been collaborative. There are some problems with some of their positions. A lot of them are kind of technical. It's a little bit difficult because the EU is, their negotiating position is determined a lot more bureaucratically than the U.S. position is. But there's room for improvement in the EU position, but if you were to compare it to the U.S., far more promising.
What are they doing that we can't? I mean, they're an advanced technological society just like ours. They move around a lot. They live in comfort just like we do. What are they doing that we can't do?
Well, one thing is that they're investing heavily in renewable energy. Most people will be surprised to hear that Germany is among the leaders of solar energy in the world, if not the top country in terms of investment and use of photovoltaic generation, so solar cells. The U.S. needs to be doing that more. We are doing that more. We have some huge solar thermal projects coming out in the southwest U.S. But we need to be looking at investment in renewables compared to investment in fossil fuels. the ratio is getting better and better in the EU. In the U.S., we still have, over the last decade or so, subsidized directly and indirectly fossil fuels at a rate of about 7-1 over renewables. So that needs to be flipped. We really shouldn't be subsidizing fossil fuels at all. And that's just one thing that you could mention. There's also other things that the EU has done in several countries that promote renewables through things such as feed-in tariffs. So this is something that some states like California have, where you have a requirement that the utility purchase renewable energy if somebody starts producing it, to put it in very simple terms. There's no requirement like that in the U.S. So if I was to put, if somebody were to decide to build a wind farm in Minnesota, there's no requirement that the utility purchase the electricity from them. Or if you're to break it down even to a smaller level than that, and we should be promoting decentralized energy projects because of land use issues, we should all be allowed to put solar cells on our house, and if we generate more electricity than we use in our house, that electricity should go back out onto the grid, and since we paid for the solar cells, we should get a credit onto our utility account for that. In Europe, they're doing that, and in the U.S., they're not doing that so much.
And a couple of the other big emitters, what's Russia up to?
Well, Russia is among the countries who, as part of the Soviet Union, have an issue that's called hot air. So when they joined the Kyoto Protocol, it had been determined that the parties of the Kyoto Protocol would have a certain amount of what are called AAUs, which stands for Assigned Amount Units. This is basically like carbon permits, which is used like currency. It's tradable. So Russia and other countries like Romania and Bulgaria and Ukraine were given a lot of these carbon permits, or AAUs, as if their economies were going to get back up to the point they were when the Soviet Union existed. But that never happened, and it never happened in part because countries like Romania and Ukraine were emitting a lot of pollution because they were producing things like tanks for the Soviet military. And so you don't have that anymore. Their economies, emissions never got up anywhere near the level that they were before. So you have this huge pool of carbon permits, the AAUs, in these countries like Russia, that drive down the price of the carbon permit, but it also makes it look like they're reducing more emissions than they are. In fact, emissions were already reduced. So if we don't deal with this problem that we're calling hot air, then Russia's emissions are probably just going to go up and up. So their position here is to try and hold on to that flexibility that they have. They're not really coming from the perspective that they're going to have to reduce emissions at all right now.
One of the big fights on the global scale is between, but this is particularly an acute issue, I think, in the United States, the sense that the developing countries are a bigger and bigger contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and they have to bear a proportionally greater share of the burden of reduction than the first world countries. So it's a matter of who's going to have to sacrifice. What's the Greenpeace position on who has to sacrifice, or should we all do it equally? How do we divide that on a global scale?
Well, there are different levels of development, first of all, to point out. I mean, every country in the world needs to contribute to dealing with climate change as best they can. We do completely agree with the principle that's called common but differentiated responsibilities, which was recognized in the UN Convention on Climate Change. The U.S. has said that they agree with that also, and that just means that countries should contribute what they can contribute based on their resources relative to other countries. So the U.S. is a very wealthy country and historically has been a very wealthy country. Historically, we're responsible for the most amount of emissions. According to the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, the U.S. should therefore have the largest burden of reducing emissions and dealing with climate change. Part of that burden will be borne out by helping other countries to develop more cleanly than we did. And so if you're to talk about an extremely poor country like Lesotho in Africa, you wouldn't expect that they would have to invest a lot of their money in reducing emissions. If they're going to reduce emissions, in fact, it's better to think about if they're going to develop in a way that results in fewer emissions than they would otherwise, they need help from wealthy countries to do that. If you're talking about another country like China, which is still considered a developing country, but way more wealthy than Lesotho. China doesn't want any adaptation. They don't want any finance to help deal with mitigation. They want to do cooperation like with technology transfer. That's how they would like to be involved with wealthy countries. But they don't want finance to reduce their emissions in the same way that very poor countries do. So there needs to be a collective effort coming from this perspective that countries should reduce or develop cleanly or according to their relative resources. And really, it shouldn't be thought of as a climate bazaar, which is what I call it in Copenhagen. Everybody has to come and contribute to dealing with climate change, and they need to think about what they can do, and they need to address the issue collectively.
Is this process really the only game in town? Is there any other way to deal with climate change aside from this process, which seems arcane and complex and not something that one can get very hopeful right now? But is it really the only game in town?
Well, I think that there's many answers to that question. One way I would answer it is to describe what the process is useful for. One of the things that this process is useful for is to develop a treaty that all countries involved in are, that they're agreed to deal with global warming, that they're legally bound to do it, because then there's some legitimacy in the effort. The world can know what's happening, and there's onus on wealthy countries like the U.S. and like blocs like the EU. But the other usefulness of this process is that this is the time when every country who cares about climate change and every organization that is working hard to address global warming back home comes and convenes to discuss the issue and advocate to other countries and other delegations perspectives of their home countries so that we can all best understand how to deal with the problem. There's no other forum that comes close to doing that. And as an example, when I'm here, I don't just speak to U.S. press, I speak to Chinese press. I don't just speak to the U.S. delegation, I speak to the Spanish delegation and to the Polish delegation and to the South African delegation. So there are few opportunities to do that on a day-to-day basis. So a two-week time when you can come and do this here, I think that is a usefulness all its own, even if there are no discussion whatsoever about having a treaty. But if you're to talk about reducing emissions outside of this process in a way that has nothing to do with this process, then the answer is to say that there are many international fora, like the G20, like the OECD, which is a club of wealthy countries, basically Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. The G20 is also described in the same way, where they can come up with agreements to deal with things that pertain to climate change. And an example would be one of the ways that we're trying to deal with fossil fuel subsidies isn't just through what the U.S. gives to the coal industry and the oil industry in the United States, but it's also the money that the U.S. sends abroad to build coal plants. So the U.S. has the export-import bank, which is one of many of what are called export credit agencies around the world, and they promote their domestic industry, so the U.S. is promoting an industry that builds parts for coal plants. So they give a loan to South Africa, in one case, that we have been fighting to build one of the largest coal plants in the world. So this is a little bit arcane, what I'm describing, but what we've been trying to do is to get the United States to promote carbon accounting and standards for export credit agencies. So we have been working with the Export and Import Bank and having discussions with them about doing this, and they, to their credit, have been bringing up this conversation in the G20 and in the OECD to try and get other countries to agree they should have accounting on their lending portfolios to show people what is the impact of carbon pollution from the loans that they're giving out to people. And then the result of that is that everyone can see the impact and it leads to standards so that hopefully one day we don't have the Export and Import Bank or eventually other banks like the World Bank giving loans out to build coal plants in other countries. They should instead be, if they have the revenue, be giving the money to build wind farms and solar plants.
And finally, I mean, it's really easy when you look at this topic to despair. It seems like the challenges are so enormous and the political will to deal with them seems elusive. Say something hopeful. Encourage me. There's really no reason to give up hope yet, is there?
Well, and in something that's encouraging is I think we're moving away from fossil fuels one way or another. We don't have to think about it as an issue as huge and intimidating as climate change. I mean, I have been studying and working on climate change for a while, and I can't say that I understand it. It's extremely complex. But I do understand a lot of the impacts of burning coal and burning oil, and we could just focus on those impacts, and we can focus on the use of those fossil fuels. We can see that in the U.S., you're talking about new forms of energy that are being used or new types of technologies that are being promoted. We're moving in the right direction. We're moving in the right direction on how much oil we're going to burn, and we're going to move in the right direction on how much coal we're going to burn. This is a trend that we're seeing in every developed country and around the world, and I think it's a trend that's going to continue, especially since people are starting to realize that there are more impacts from burning coal, just to stick to one fossil fuel, than climate change. You don't have to understand climate change to understand the impact of coal. You have to understand asthma from living next to a coal plant. You have to understand acid rain from sulfur dioxide. And we've had successful regulation to deal with those issues. And if we can focus on those successes, I think that we can keep moving in the right direction.
All right, thanks for finding a hopeful note to end on.
That was Kyle Ash of Greenpeace, who's down at the Climate Talks in Cancun. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, new from the Gang of Four, the song Sleeper, a taste from their new CD, which is coming out next month. They've just released a few advanced tracks on the web. Till next week, bye.
Stars.